Everybody, welcome to episode 489 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast, presented by Overdrive. This is Adam, joined by Jill. How's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm in our office because I wanted to go to the local coffee shop by our office, Gourmands, to get some coffee to make it home. That was like my only real reason to come in, but I also had bunches of books. But for people who work in a big office that are going every once in a while, like we have access to, it is very like, it's almost like spooky to get here first thing in the morning and there just be no one in this giant office.
Right.
But it's, you know, it is what it is.
I did hear the front desk is all Halloween-y though.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Okay. So for people who don't know, which is the overwhelming majority of you, because most of you don't work at Overdrive, our company is amazing at Halloween. And so when I got here this morning, I guess I wasn't thinking that like, oh, they're probably still going to decorate the office since like on any given day, there's 15 people here, yeah. Like several hundred. And it is, there's like hanging ghosts. And yeah, the front desk is like creepy. Like I went over there at like 7 a.m. to grab a book that had gotten delivered for me. And I was like, I don't like this actually. It's very dark. And yeah, it's kudos to Paul, who I don't know if he listens to our podcast, but Paul, who works at Overdrive, who does like all of the event type things at our office. He's doing a good job, even though only a few of us are going to see it. So, highly recommend people who do work here, come check it out. It's very creepy. You talked about one book last time that we recorded an intro, and spoiler alert, we're recording this 30 seconds after the other one. So were there any other books that you wanted to talk about, or was it just the one? I'm putting you on the spot, and I'm sorry.
No, there is one. I have to open my spreadsheet back up. This one is a novella that I read in like an afternoon because sometimes you just need to like check out. It's called Wrapped. It's by Rebecca Weatherspoon. It's a romance. Novella is very short. It's like Christmas themed, which is one of those like cozy romance. Well, actually, let me rephrase that. It's a romance. It is a very steamy one. It's not like cozy. It's like a steamy one. But it's about she owns a bake shop and she matches with this guy that she used to work with on a dating app. And they meet up and, you know, hook up, and it was good. It was cute. I mean, again, cute's not the right word. It was a delightful read. It was a delightful read, but it is like on the scale, it's a very like hot, steamy book in a good way. I enjoyed it. And yeah, sometimes you just need, you know, you just need like a short novella. Novellas are great for that. Mm-hmm. When you just need something like bite-sized to read and you want to complete it. So that is Wrapped. Yeah, and it's Christmas themed. It's around Christmas time.
Nice. Speaking of, yeah, you said cozy, even though not that book, and then kind of like comforting. I read, I just finished Alice Hoffman's new book, Magic Lessons, which we previewed, I think, for October, but it's the prequel to Practical Magic and Rules of Magic. And same thing, it was very just like delightful. When she was on the show, I talked about how I really like how she writes stories about witches, but they're not like their magic is all based from the earth, and like it's all, you know, using herbs and creating tea and, you know, using like roots of plants and various things to work their magic. And so it's, if you are familiar with Practical Magic, you don't need to have been to start with this book, but you do get like lots of little Easter egg type of things. So it's very, very delightful. And same thing, like Alice Hoff, the way that she writes feels very like comforting to me. So that was quite enjoyable. Today's episode is going to be an interview that I did with Anne Cleves, who is an award-winning crime writer who is just, speaking of delightful, she's a delightful human being. She has a new book out called The Darkest Evening, and it is a Vera Stanhope book. Vera Stanhope is her wildly popular, unglamorous, yet brilliant detective. Those are words on her own website that she uses to describe her character, so I'm not calling her unglamorous, but it's really, really fun. It's very much in the sense of like an Agatha Christie, like Clue kind of a murder in a house type of a book, where the characters initially can't leave because there's a huge snowstorm. And Anne is interesting because she spent several decades of her life being a writer, but like, as she kind of said, like a writer with no like acclaim. She just was like, her book releases would be like having a couple of people over at a library to chat. And like, that was it. And then people fell in love with Vera. And now it's interesting to hear her in like kind of her later years of her life talk about how much she both enjoys the fame and notoriety of everything, but she also just loves talking to like one or two people at a time about her books. And it was a really interesting conversation. So I'm excited if you guys listen to this. If people want to get a hold of us, how can they do that?
You can go to our website, professionalbooknerds.com. We are on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds. And you can email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com.
Yes, you can. Okay. I'm not going to keep you guys any longer. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Anne Cleaves on the Professional Book Nerds podcast.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
So we always love starting off our conversations by having the author kind of introduce the book. So can you give our listeners a little bit of an introduction to The Darkest Evening?
Yeah, The Darkest Evening is the ninth of the Vera Stanhope books. And I think Vera, the TV show, is quite popular in the US too. Mm-hmm. So people might know her from that rather than just the books. And it starts off with Vera driving home in a blizzard. It's snowy. It's nearly Christmas time. And she loses concentration or just loses her way and ends up on a road that she doesn't recognize with the forest curved round one side of her, and then sees that a car has slowed off the road because of the weather. And she goes to investigate and the driver's door is open, but there's nobody there. And she thinks the driver's just wandered off to get phone reception or to find help. And then hears a cry in the back, and it's a toddler strapped in a seat at the back. And so that's how it starts, really. And Vera takes the toddler with her to try and find help and ends up at this big country house called Brockbank, which she recognizes immediately because it's where her father grew up. Mm-hmm. Her father, who's the black sheep of a country gentry. And so we find out a bit about the investigation about who killed the child's mother, but also about Vera and her background and her family history.
Yeah, so that part I'm really interested, because people have known Vera for so long. Was it exciting for you to kind of get into delve into, you know, her family history and like where, you know, her, you know, her father's upbringing, kind of like almost,
yeah, I think,
new lore?
I think I always knew it, but sometimes you forget to tell readers. So that was quite fun to go back and remind myself, but also to remind readers that Vera had this neglectful father called Hector, who was on very much on the edge of the law and countryside pursuits. And he might have been a good father, but his wife, the love of his life, died, and he just wasn't interested in the child. So that relationship between the father and the daughter has fed into Vera's life, really. Yeah. Makes her who she is.
Yeah, and I've seen you say a number of times that you always start writing from place. Is that, you know, I know that you use,
you know, the atmosphere of the area as a whole as a really great way to sort of ground your stories and then find out, you know, discover your characters. But did this story really come from Brockburn and being able to, you know, kind of almost trap everyone in this singular location like that?
Well, that was fun because it takes us back as well to the golden age of murder mystery, doesn't it? The big mm-hmm. country house and the snow. So it was quite fun to play with that trope, you know, that idea, because it's very much based in 1930s, 40s, golden age fiction. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to very much bring that up to date because I live up in the Northumberland Hills, or I have a house up in the Northumberland Hills where I live for part of the time. And it's a worker's cottage. It's on a big country estate. So at one time it would have belonged to the housekeeper or the chauffeur or somebody at the mm-hmm. big house. And the family still live there, and they are quite eccentric. I mean, much more eccentric than the people in the book. But I wanted to, I suppose, explore that relationship between people who own land and people who live on it. And it brings privilege to have that. But quite often people who own land have very little cash. And so there is that sense of responsibility and of obligation too for the people who are living and working with them. So a way of looking at the English class system in quite a lighthearted way, I suppose. Mm.
Well, and then also having, you know, using the weather to trap them in that singular location, it really forces, you know, I like you said, you're thinking about the old Agatha Christie novels and even like the very famous movie Clue, where it's like everyone yeah. is, they're forced almost to interact with each other and figure out what's going on because they can't leave.
Yeah, though of course they're only there in the book for one night and then they do leave, and it's more about, I suppose, the village and the other people who mm-hmm. who are dependent on the Stanhopes for work and for livelihood, mm-hmm. the other people in the village.
And I've also seen you say that you write from the beginning of your books and you sort of discover characters and actions and twists as they happen. So does that make for a challenging almost edit when you go back to sort of, you know, leave those like breadcrumbs and things for people? Or, you know, I imagine it really does help keep the twists and turns extremely fresh, seeing as how you don't even know when they're coming as well.
Yeah, I suppose the plot lines, that's something that I find most tricky. You know, what's going to happen next? And not knowing and not planning in advance does, as you say, keeps it fresh and keeps it interesting for me. I would have no interest in writing a book when I knew exactly what has happened. Now, I know that there are people who do very carefully plot and know what's going to happen in each chapter. And part of me thinks that would be brilliant because it would be so reassuring and so comforting and so easy. But that's so boring to just be telling a story that you knew in advance. So, yeah, no, I don't work that way. I think because I had 25 years of not having any commercial success, 20 mm-hmm. years certainly of no commercial success, you know, writing a book a year, mostly going into libraries, being very much supported by the Library Book Fund, but very rarely making it onto the popular bookshop, mm-hmm. the chain bookshop shelves, that it had to be fun because I was making so little money. I couldn't justify it as work. So I had to be enjoying it.
Yeah, because this is your 30th novel in 30 years, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think it might be the 32nd or 31st, but certainly going along that way.
Yeah, and I know what you mean, because writing is such a, you know, even people who truly enjoy it, it can be a tedious task from now and then. So yeah, writing for all those years, and like you said, and before you got commercial success, I would imagine you would probably want to enjoy it, especially as
you
like a...
do. Yeah, and I do. I love it. That's the bit that I love best, is sitting at the kitchen table and making up stories. I think it's what is hardwired into humans. It's always how we've tried to explain the world around us is by turning them into fiction, you know, from Beowulf up to the present day. I love doing best.
Yeah, and on top of that, I think, you know, when a book is a quote unquote murder mystery, like I feel like that is a great hook to get people interested in a story, you know, especially when you see all the suspense and thriller books that come out. But you know, I think that's a nice way to kind of figure it. People like to figure out who done it or why done it or how done it. But then it also lets you play with, you know, you've got people there, but what you can do is have that murder mystery sort of be the backdrop where you can then, like you said, play with relationships and how people would react in these unique situations.
That's absolutely it. That in fact, the structure of the classic detective story, which I suppose I still write in, you know, there is a murder near the beginning of the book, there's a limited number of suspects, and there is some form of resolution at the end. That frees me up really to write about what I really want to write about, because I don't have to worry too much about the plot. That structure that, I think it was Katrina McPherson who said that that structure, it's not a straitjacket, it's like a corset that holds you up and contains you. And I think that's great, because within that you can look at the things that I'm really interested in, which is, I suppose, about how people grow out of the places where they're born and where they're raised, and about fractured families, and mostly about community, what holds communities together and what makes them fall apart.
Well, and it also offers, I would imagine as a writer, it offers such a unique situation to put these characters, even if you know them in your head, or if they're a part of Vera's series of books and, you know, we've seen them before or not, I imagine it gives you an ability to really show how you think people would interact in these extreme situations, because every single murder mystery that's written is a new opportunity to explore that dynamic.
Of course, and I'm not interested at all in writing about monsters. You know, I don't write pacey serial killers, or I write about ordinary people, and I want to understand them. And so part of the process of writing is getting to know these people better and trying to work out what they would do in such stressful circumstances. So yeah, that's how it works, I think.
Well, and I've also seen you say that reading murder mysteries, despite it being a thrilling, kind of sometimes unnerving aspect while you're doing it, it really can also be a comfort, especially times like now, because you do get, in most circumstances anyways, you do get a resolution towards the end. Is that accurate?
You do get a sense of order restored and justice prevailing. And certainly at a time like this, probably more in the US than here, that's what we need, I think, is that sense that right will triumph in the end, or some sort of natural justice or order will be restored at the end. And it's quite interesting going back over history to see when the traditional crime novel was most popular. And it always, certainly in the UK, I think it's a very different form, the crime fiction in the US, but in the UK, the golden age of crime fiction was the 1930s. And people think of that as being, you know, big country houses and smart people. But it was the time of the Great Depression. It was the Jarrow hunger marches. People weren't sure. It was the rise of fascism in Europe. People were as uncertain then as we are now, I think. And I think that's why it was a time for people to read those sort of books, because they were, as we said, they were, in a sense, they gave a sense of hope at the end. And then with us, it was the next big time, I suppose, was Ruth Rendell and P.D. James, was the 70s and 80s. And again, it was a time of political turmoil here. Thatcherism, the closing of the pits, the deindustrialization of whole swathes of the country. And interesting again that was a time when great crime writers came into their own. And then again now, I think that there is a resurgence of that very traditional crime writing.
Yeah, and especially you mentioned in the States here, like with there being so much upheaval with police brutality and police violence, and it's a situation where no matter where people stand politically in the United States, there's still this huge confrontation going on with people in charge. And I think you're absolutely right, where it's nice to be able to read a story about Vera or about Hercule Poirot, whoever it is, that you can trust that the person in charge has everyone's. Yeah, exactly. And it is comforting to be able to escape into a world that's not so different from this one, but also feels like there's a clearly established sense of right and wrong.
I think that what I write about, and I think it's a quality that is very sexy and very underrated, is kindness. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's why people like Vera so much. Yeah, she's a loner. Yes, she's an authoritative. She's a woman of a certain age who is the boss and who knows what she's doing. But at the heart of her, there is a certain compassion and that strong sense of justice. So, but I think with crime fiction, especially now, I don't know, again, it's hard for me to talk about America, but here, lots of police officers are spending as much time with people who are mentally ill, looking for an emergency hospital place for them, as they are with what we would normally consider crimes. You know, there's a lot of social work going on the front line of the police service. And I think that allows people who write police procedurals to look at things like social justice and the problems of homelessness, of family breakdown, because the police are more and more being involved with that because our social services are short of cash and there's very little community care for people with poor mental health. So we're allowed to explore all those areas, I think.
Well, and then I also think that exploring those areas makes the characters even more relatable because, you know, one of the things I've always loved about Vera is she feels like a real person. She doesn't feel like a superhero or a completely like unstoppable force of a, you know, just like something that is omnipotent. And there is this understanding, or like you said, she is, you know, in the darkest evening, she realizes, you know, gets deeper into the troubling past she had with her father. And it just shows a grounded character that I think we can all relate to, which is important in these times, you know,
well,
especially
I hope so.
This time.
Yeah. I hope so.
Did you, you know, setting this during, you know, kind of the winter and the location and everything that you did, it does feel very much like Hercule Poirot's Christmas and that, you know, traditional Christmas time murder mystery. Like, did you feel any added pressure writing a story knowing that people were going to be comparing it to those specific types of murder mysteries?
No, you see, I don't feel any pressure because for so long I wrote and was not in the public eye and nobody knew who I was and what I was doing. And, you know, it was astonishing to meet somebody who'd actually read one of the books. So I'm quite relaxed about it all now. You know what? It's great, but that's down to luck because there are so many brilliant crime writers out there who haven't had the luck that I've had. And I know that so much commercial success is actually down to good marketing teams and brilliant publicists. Mm-hmm. And you can write a great book, but without that, you won't have that sort of success. So I'm quite grounded and realistic about the whole thing. I don't believe that I have to write a great novel each time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really floored by poor reviews enjoy writing.
And I saw I was laughing. I saw you were on an event like this, but that was, I believe, was streamed, and you were talking about some of your small library gatherings and your experiences. Yeah. And you would talk about the honesty of readers when you're right in front of them. And we in normal times, my co-host and I, we host events for our local library here in Cleveland, and it is so. You talk about not worrying about harsh reviews. I feel like, as an author, you are told those things in person to your fan, like by your fans. They don't even mean to be harsh, but they'll say things at those library events that I imagine toughen you up pretty well.
I think they have to, yeah. And because that was really, I didn't do any big literary festivals or for years and years and years. So it was small groups in libraries, and they have so much that's interesting to say, and they're so passionate about reading. But also what you realize is that the book isn't really yours once it goes to a reader, because each reader reads it differently and they bring their own perspective and their own history and their own prejudice to the book. And so really that helped me when the book was adapted for television, because it meant that really I just saw handing it over to a director and a script writer just one stage further, and I was quite happy to let it go, really. I don't feel precious about the material they can the team can do what they like with it, pretty much.
That's really interesting that you say that, because we've had a few other kind of suspense writers say the same thing. Harlan Coben is another one whose books have been, you know, turned into movies and TV shows, and he told us the same thing. Like, once he sets a book out in the world, he turns it over to the readers. But we've also had people tell us that throughout the editing process, it can be hard to let go. So when you're writing the stories, and like we've talked about, you are churning out literally a novel a year every year, so I feel like you can't be too precious with it because it has to get out there. But do you feel apprehensive ever before it gets released that you don't know if it's ready to be shown to the world?
Oh, I wouldn't let it go if I didn't think it was ready. There is it's a book a year is really quite manageable, I think, especially if you're doing it full time and especially if you've got good editors. So I'm very lucky. I'm published by St. Martin's in the States and by Pan Macmillan here, and they're all part of the same group, Macmillan. They're all part of Macmillan. And so I get two sets of notes, or one set of notebook from two editors. So my American and my English editor work together on the notes, on the feedback, so that it means that I'm not having to think specially about a US audience or a US readership. So I'll write, I'll think about the book from both those perspectives, because I get the edits from both of them. And they're just very helpful, because you are so close to it when you're writing it, that there are things that you know that you forget to tell the reader. And sometimes there are scenes that you think, I'm not sure this is working, but you hope that it'll slide through all right. And an editor will pick it up immediately. And you need somebody to do that. You know, if you're feeling a bit idle one day, you really need someone to say, no, this isn't working, or you need to think about this again. Or, and I think that, and my agents, my US and my UK agents are also co-agents, so they work together. So I get a first set of notes from them, and then another set of notes from two very experienced editors. So by that time, I'm relatively confident that it's okay. I mean, they're very kind, but they are very, well, my US agent especially can be quite brutal. You know, if it's not working, they'll tell you. And that's how it has to be. Because I think we've all read books that haven't been sufficiently edited, where maybe the editor's a bit scared of the author and won't criticize, and but you need it because you're so close that you definitely need a fresh pair of eyes on it.
I was just going to say, you strike me as someone who feels very comfortable in that process now, I imagine, after doing it for so long. But I know that there are certainly writers out there who are much more challenging to work with, and they think that their zero drafts is the way that it should go. But it sounds like you, having done this for so long and churning out these books so quickly, it sounds like it really is a very collaborative effort for you with your editor.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if there's something that I'm really sure about and that I know that it's right for me and for the characters in the book, then it stays. You know, I am the god in my universe. It's my decision in the end what goes into the book. But I'm certainly open to listening to other people's points of view at that point. And quite often they're right.
Do you find yourself, while you're writing your books, do you find yourself also reading in this genre, or do you try to kind of read outside of the genre so it doesn't intertwine with what you're writing?
No, I read both. I try and read as widely as I can, but I love crime fiction. I'm not going to stop reading crime fiction because I'm writing it, because it has always been my comfort reading and I love it. And there are some brilliant crime writers who are doing all sorts of different things with it. I think certainly in the UK, I don't know so much about the American market, though I do have some favourite writers there. But it is like a new golden age. We've got some brilliant young crime writers coming up who have got a fresh voice and a new outlook on the world. And so I'm very excited by how crime fiction's developing.
Has there been anything that you've read lately that has really like kind of jumped out at you? Not to put you on the spot, but
yeah, no, there are a number of books really. And again, looking, I suppose the couple that I'm thinking of first by two women, Kath Staincliffe and Kaz Freer, both police procedurals, but really very interesting voices and looking at society and conflict and social justice. Mm-hmm. So they were very good. And then you know, there's someone like Mick Herron, who I think everybody knows now, who writes those hugely entertaining spy Jackson Lamb books. Mm-hmm. And then someone like Abhi Mukherjee, but also Vaseem Khan, who set their books in India in the past. Mm-hmm. Abhi Mukherjee at the beginning of the 20th century, so just before independence.
Yeah.
And Vas Khan has just written one called Midnight at Malabar House, which is set in the 50s, which again is very golden age in flavour, but very, very interesting take on the traditional crime novel.
Yeah, that was a big buzzy book over here in the States as well. That was it's funny because at Overdrive, where I work, we work with digital content all the time, but we have a whole team of staff librarians who work here, and it's really interesting to see they have like their own little kind of wheelhouses where they all, like, I know if I'm looking for a cozy mystery to go to talk to a specific person, but it seems like the murder mystery is a very, I don't want to say it's like a stereotypical librarian like thing that they're all fans of. They just, all of our librarians happen to be very much in that genre. So that was a book that we all very much adored for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah. Well, yes, I'm just trying to think of, there are lots of great authors coming through now.
So I've also seen, you know, you talk a lot about how, because of the fact that you write from a sense of place in Northumberland being so integral in the stories that you write, it's a bit of a smaller area, correct? Not area, but population wise, there's not a ton of people. Is that accurate?
Northumberland is probably the least populated county in the UK mm-hmm. per square mile, because it's quite big. It runs from the Scottish border right down to the River Tyne, and then west almost across to the west coast as well. So it's a big area geographically, but it has one big city, Newcastle on Tyne is in it. But
so how do you think that area affects the stories that you're
telling? That's where I start from, and it's not just landscape though, that's important. You know, I think if you grow up with long horizons and big skies, you see the world in a different place from if you grow up in an apartment in a big city. But it's about community. So in the Northeast, we did have a lot of coal mines, you know, the coals to Newcastle thing, mm-hmm. lots and lots of pits. And when we first moved here in the 1980s, there were still working mines then. But all those were closed very suddenly, leaving behind real pockets of deprivation and communities where there was no work and where generation after generation were unemployed. And so I can write about that. And then I can write about the big wealthy landowners mm-hmm. further inland. And I can write about faded seaside towns, as I do in The Seagull, or prosperous market towns. And within quite a small one county, we have all those different communities.
Yeah, it's interesting. We are thousands of miles apart, but I grew up in a small city called Lorraine. It's actually where Toni Morrison is from, and it's like our one claim to fame. But it was a steel factory town. It's on a lake here in the States called Lake Erie, and mm-hmm. very much the same when all of the steel manufacturing jobs started leaving the country, our city did much the same. Where this all those they closed up, and then you know there's such this difference depending where you're at in the county between you know the higher upper class people and those who are really down on their luck. And I think that might be why I enjoy your story so much, because despite the fact that we're half world away from each other, they feel they feel like it's a story that anyone from really any area of the world understands, these types of societal differences based on money.
Yeah, and left behind towns, but also here as well. I think, I mean, it's hard now because of COVID. So all sorts of, we don't have a anymore a thriving arts community, but certainly in Newcastle, which was a very depressed, very deprived, rundown city, it has regenerated through culture, through a big music centre and great theatre, mm-hmm. and it's so sad to see that fading away now we obviously can't open theatres, and big music centres are not opening anymore either. So it's so sad to see that.
Yeah, and that has been something that throughout COVID, it's been interesting to see. There's been, musicians can, they can do socially distant concerts, and we, with authors, you can do this sort of thing. But yeah, live theater, it's really challenging to replicate. You can't really do any type of a streaming service outside of having a massive budget like they did with like Hamilton and anything like that. But yeah, it is. I hope that the theater districts can rebound.
Yeah, we tried to do just for a bit of fun. If you look on my website, I wrote a murder mystery, which is around The Darkest Evening, but it's because in the past I've sent scripts out to libraries, because it's something you can do to pull in new readers, actually. They're very, very popular, these. So, it's like a game of Cluedo, but you have four suspects and you have set it up. There is a murder and you hear the witness statements and then there's a confession. But we actually have done it live. So we took four actors out into the Northumberland countryside, and people can have a look at that. And I'm thinking maybe we could do that as a socially distanced thing, like people do Zoom pub quizzes. That you could use that as something that might bring a reading group together virtually if people want to use it. It's free. You can just use it if you want to.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I watched that this morning, and for everyone listening, I will put it in our show notes so that they can see it. It's so fun, and it's a different story from The Darkest Evening, so it's not like a spoiler.
But it uses the characters and the background.
Right, but it's, I hope more people continue to do that sort of thing, because like you said, it is, especially with, we're staring down fall and winter here, at least where I'm from, and we're all going to be shuttered in inside again. The murder mystery, it is such a fun concept. Is that something that you wanted to do, like that you came up with the script writing, or how did that come to be?
I did it. In 1999, we had a National Year of Reading here in the UK. So the idea was to promote reading in all its forms. And I was made reader in residence for a couple of local authorities here in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And one of the librarians said to me, I want something that will bring people who don't normally come into the library into the library. And these murder mystery dinners are very, very popular. So can you write us a script? So I wrote a script called Brought to Book, I think we called it, set in a library. And it was just a very four simple monologues, very similar to the ones that are on the website. And we got loads and loads of people in, and we got them into, we had a form and you could write down who you think did it, and then a reason, and we worked out who the winner was, and then the murderer stood up and read the confession, just as in the YouTube film. And people loved it. And so every now and again, I'll do a fresh one, because libraries are always asking for them, because it's something a bit different to bring people into the library. And I've done them for St Hilda's Conference, the Murder Mystery Conference, and fundraisers use them, women's groups and church groups use them as a fundraiser. So the script is there on the website as well, so you can download the script if you want to read them yourself. But we thought that as we couldn't get people together in libraries to use it, we would film it, so that if people want to somehow do it virtually, I think it would certainly be possible to do that, because you could get people to write what they thought the motive was and photograph it and Zoom it in or email it in to the organizer, and you'd still be able to have a winner.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I'll make sure that I have it in our show notes, because it's so much fun and I loved it. I got really excited when I saw that. It's delightful.
So, and it provided a bit of work for a couple of actors.
Yeah, exactly. Helping out everybody there. So we always end our podcast by asking one last question, which is, what do you hope readers take away from The Darkest Evening?
I hope they take away, I think it's that idea of kindness that and honesty, because both those things are what keep family together. You know, you need to talk, you need to be honest, but you need to be kind.
I think that's absolutely perfect. The book is wonderful, and I believe Vera is shooting for the next season currently.
They started filming today, which is very brave because we do have a spike of infection here, but they're looking after the cast and crew really well. I won't be able to visit because they're just keeping it very much to the people who need to be there. Yeah, yeah, but they started filming today, just a couple of miles from where I live. And then Facebook things are with pictures of Brenda coming out of a house. And
oh, that's fantastic. Well, can't wait to watch that. And like I said, I know everyone who hasn't read The Darkest Evening yet is going to love it. And thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much indeed. Thanks, Adam.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.